Stay tuned for a Juno Afternoon. We'll learn about Family Day at the City Museum. We'll talk with Tristan Knudsen-Lombardo about suicide prevention efforts. And we'll hear from Coast Guard Rear Admiral Mike McAllister about a new ship. First, a look at the weather. The rest of today, numerous rain showers, highs in the mid-50s with some light winds. Isolated rain showers this evening with lows around 40. Tomorrow, partly sunny, highs in the mid-50s with some light winds. Wednesday night, back to scattered rain showers, which we'll see again on Thursday.
This is National Native News. I'm Sarah Gustavus in for Antonia Gonzalez. U.S. Secretary of the Interior Ryan Zinke recommended that the federal government reduce the size of Bears Ears National Monument in southeast Utah. President Obama designated the 1.3 million acre monument under the Antiquities Act in December 2016. Bears Ears is one of 27 national monuments currently under review by the Trump administration. Zinke suggested in an interim report that the federal government work with tribes to co-manage key cultural sites. The Bears Ears Intertribal Coalition, a consortium of five tribes, advocated for the designation of the monument. The coalition opposed the idea of changing the monument in a statement Monday, citing the cultural and historical importance of the entire area. South Dakota residents will soon have a chance to show their support for indigenous culture. The state is offering license plates featuring a newly revealed statue that honors the Lakota and Dakota people. South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Gary Ellenbolt reports.
Several years ago, artist Dale Lamphere was commissioned to create a statue to honor the Lakota and Dakota culture. Last September, the 50-foot Dignity statue was unveiled near the Missouri River at Chamberlain, South Dakota. The 50-foot depiction of a Native American woman wrapped in a star quilt is visible from Interstate 90. It represents the courage, perseverance, and wisdom of the Lakota and Dakota people. Beginning July 1st, the state of South Dakota will offer license plates that feature the Dignity statue. Dale Lamphere helped design the plates. In addition to regular license plate fees, these plates will cost an extra $10 plus a $5 mailing fee. For National Native News, I'm Gary Ellen Bolt.
Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau and Perry Bellegarde, National Chief of the Assembly of First Nations, signed a Memorandum of Understanding this week to increase engagement and build a stronger nation-to-nation relationship. The MOU creates a permanent bilateral mechanism process. The Government of Canada and Assembly of First Nations will meet at least three times each year to discuss shared priorities. Prime Minister Trudeau will chair at least one of those meetings. The Assembly of First Nations represents First Nations citizens in Canada. The process began in December 2016, and Monday's meeting was the third this year. The aim of the process outlined in the MOU includes increasing engagement with the government on First Nations priorities, discussing treaty rights, and supporting opportunities for First Nations people in Canada. The Senate Committee on Indian Affairs is expected to review key bills this week that affect Indian country. Chairman John Hoeven, a Republican from North Dakota, and Tom Udall, a Democrat from New Mexico, will lead the business meeting and legislative hearing on Tuesday. The committee is expected to hear testimony on amendments to the Indian Health Care Improvement Act that would address recruitment and retention of IHS employees. Another bill under consideration aims to improve housing conditions in tribal communities. A vote is scheduled on a bill co-sponsored by Senator Udall that would expand the Amber Alert warning system to Native communities. The legislation was created after the murder of 11-year-old Ashlyn Mike on the Navajo Nation last year. Authorities did not immediately issue an Amber Alert after Ashlyn was abducted. Few tribes are currently connected to the alert system, which notifies people via cell phone of suspected child abductions. The Mescalero Apache Tribe and Eastern New Mexico University recently announced an official partnership to ensure academic programs and services are accessible for local tribal members. A formal agreement between the tribe and university was signed on June 1st in Mescalero, New Mexico. Both university and tribal officials say the agreement formalizes a long-standing collaboration to support higher education opportunities. Students can attend classes at the local campus and online. I'm Sarah Gustavus.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
Support by the Northwest Portland Area Indian Health Board.
Were you born from 1945 through 1965? People born during these years have the highest rates of hepatitis C, yet most don't know they are infected. Hepatitis C is the leading cause of liver cancer, but you can do something about it. Talk to your doctor about getting tested. It could save your life. Visit www.cdc.gov/nomorehepatitis.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
And welcome to a Juno Afternoon. I'm Lori Scandling, your volunteer host for today. In the studio is our producer, Jeff Brown. I appreciate him being my co-host, really, every opportunity that I am given to participate in Juno Afternoon. My first guest this afternoon is Kaya Hendrickson. She is the Public Programs Coordinator with our City Museum. Welcome. Glad to have you here.
Thank you.
And specifically, we're going to be talking about Family Day at the City Museum, which is a new effort. Is that correct, Kaya?
Yes, this is a new program we're starting this month.
Tell us about what it is and why it's being started.
Well, we've been looking for ways to bring more families into the museum and offer more programs for kids on a regular basis. And so starting this month and then continuing once a month through September and possibly beyond, we'll be offering a family day. And during the hours of the event, so this Saturday, it will be from 1 to 3 p.m., adults who come with their kids will receive free admission. Kids 12 and under are always free. And we'll have activities related to Juno history or an exhibit in the museum that are just drop-in, so kids can come in and do the activity. You don't have to be there from 1, 2, 3. It'll be an ongoing event. And this month, we're going to be focusing on learning origami. And I also have a book from our collection called A Place Where Sunflowers Grow, which is aimed at ages 5 to 10 and talks a little bit about the Japanese internment history. We have an exhibit right now of Fumi Matsumoto's artwork from the Empty Chair Project exhibit on view. So after we're done with the project, if kids want, they can see how she incorporates origami and other Japanese art forms into her works and explore the museum and enjoy all of the hands-on activities we have for kids.
Maybe you could do a description of what the Empty Chair Project is in case we have listeners who may not be familiar with that commemoration.
Sure. The Empty Chair Project was a project, and in fact, it's still ongoing in providing education to the community. But the folks who started the project wanted to find a way to honor the Japanese Americans from Juneau who were sent off to internment camps during World War II. And also to tell the story of what happened when they returned. The Juneau community was as supportive as they could be at the time of those folks and tried to preserve their homes and businesses. John Tanaka, one of the children in one of the families, was a high school student who was scheduled to graduate that year of the internment, and they had to leave Juno in April, and so the school district actually had a special graduation just for him, and during the regular ceremony, they placed an empty chair to represent his space. He was the valedictorian, and it was a way of quietly protesting what was happening to those families and people who were really an integral part of our community.
Give me an example of a hands-on activity that any kid could do just about any day of the week at the City Museum. While there may be origami as part of the special focus this Saturday, what else can kids get their hands around at the museum?
We have lots of interactive exhibits. We have a small model fish trap that kids can take stuffed fish and push into the trap and see how they would be trapped in there and remove them. We have a canoe paddle interactive that's a matching activity. We have stereograph viewers where you press a button and it lights up an old time scene of Juno from Juneau's history. In our hands-on mining room, we have a dress-up closet. We have mining-related toys and miners' helmets and tags that kids could wear to represent the tags that miners would wear when they went in and out of the mines. We have a small-scale stamp mill that you can actually turn and get a sense for how loud the mining operations must have been. We have a hydropower interactive that you can actually create electricity. So it shows how water would create electricity, and it has a generator that you turn that actually lights up a little picture of the AJ mine.
So any day of the week, if you're 12 or under, you can get in free to the City Museum, which, if folks don't know, it's at the top of Main Street.
Yes, we're right across from the Capitol Building.
So in the recent budget struggles with our city, trying to consider how to save money at a time in Alaska's economy that is very difficult, one of the items that was considered for pretty severe cutbacks was the City Museum. You've just described how a child might experience the museum. How is the museum relevant to adults and to our community anymore?
The museum is really a place where the history of Juneau is being told, and that's not necessarily happening anywhere else in town. The Alaska State Museum is a wonderful museum. It has a different focus. It's giving us the history of the whole state, and the City Museum tells the story of Juneau and the people who have lived here, from the first people, the Akontakuquan, all the way through people who are living here today. We're a space for both history and local art. We offer artist space every winter to mostly local folks to exhibit their work. People trust us with belongings from their family as a way to storehouse them and to keep them safe and to tell the story of Juneau families to future generations. So I really feel like the museum, presents like a memory house for Juneau and a way for our residents to honor our history.
About how many visitors annually does the City Museum host? Do you keep track of those numbers?
We do keep track of those numbers. I can't say right off of the top of my head what those numbers are. I know that, during the winter time, we probably have over 1,000 school kids who come through the museum or are touched by our programs in one way or another. And then over the summer, of course, we have local visitors as well as folks visiting from out of town. The last few days, we've been busy all day with both local people bringing in visiting family and people coming off of the cruise ships or independent travelers. So I can't give you an exact number, but I know that it's a fair amount.
Maybe not a million, but more than 1,000.
Yes.
What are some of the other things that programmatically that the museum and or its board may be considering, as well as what you've just discussed, which is the family opportunities once a month? Are there other initiatives that are being talked about?
We are going to be open Sundays starting next month, which is really fantastic. We received some funding from the Benito and Francis C. Gagin Foundation, Michelle and Robert Storer, Allison E. Brown, and the Friends of the Juneau Douglas City Museum. And so that is going to allow us to expand our hours and offer Sunday hours in July, August, and September. And then it also enables us to restore the public programs position to full-time for the fiscal year 2018. And because of that, we're hoping to be able to expand our program offerings. Next week, we're going to be hosting a program at the Douglas Library where Sheila Kelly is presenting on Treadwell Gold, and that'll be from 7 to 8 p.m. We are also...
Is she the author of that book?
She is the author of that book, yes. And so it will be... She'll be presenting on Treadwell history, specifically... information that from her research, and that will be to as kind of a lead-in to the Perseverance performance, which starts on the 22nd.
Sure, and of course this is the 100th anniversary of three of the four Treadwell mines experiencing the cave-in.
Yes.
In April.
We have been, we are already working on some of our fall programming. We offer coffee and collections, usually once a month in the fall at least, and so that's a Saturday program that relates to the things we have on exhibit. Sometimes if we have a local artist exhibiting, we'll have an art-related program or history. This spring we had a panel program on Mount Juno related to the exhibit we have right now of art and recreational objects relating to Mount Juno. In February, when we had the artists in residence from the Greening Cabin with their work exhibiting in our gallery, some of the artists came and the people in charge of the program to talk about the program and its history. So we try to offer those programs once a month in the winter time, and we often will have at least one or two evening programs happening each month for adults and kids programs. I'm hoping, this is my first year at the museum, so I'm hoping to get a better start with the school district next year in encouraging more school groups to come visit the museum and doing outreach. And we're also trying to present some more programs off-site. So we know it's hard for people to make it to the museum, and especially parking downtown can be a nightmare. So last week we had a program out at the Valley Library, and then Sheila Kelly's program will be at the Douglas Library. So we're hoping to do some more programming out in the Valley to help expand our reach into the other parts of the community.
Well, Kaya, for having a not full-time job, it sounds like, there seem to be quite a plethora of programs and opportunities. We're talking with Kaya Hendrickson. She is the Public Programs Coordinator for the City Museum, which is at the top of Main Street here in our community. We're talking about Family Day, which will be this Saturday from 1 to 3 at the museum. And if you arrive with a youngster, you, as the grown-up, get in free, too, and there will be a variety of activities around the theme of the Japanese internment time during World War II. Kai, if people want to know more about the City Museum and or Friends of the City Museum, how would you direct them?
They can go to our website, which is www.juno.org/library/museum. And we do have a link to our Friends organization from our homepage. And there are tabs along the right for all kinds of resources about the museum, from general information, links to our newsletter, what programs we have upcoming, research. So if you're doing research about Juno and you would like some more access to information, we have a lot of resources available online from our website.
And do you know when the museum was established? I'm recalling, gosh, many years ago when it used to be at the wharf, and it's had other locations around town until it found its home at the top of the hill. Do you know about how many years the City Museum has been around?
I think it's about 25 or 30 years. It may be more than that. I believe we've been in the present location since 1989. And our building, of course, used to be the Memorial Library. So
I remember that, too. Well, thank you for your time, Kaya. And if you're interested in the monthly family program at the City Museum, drop by this Saturday anytime between 1 and 3. And if you're with a young person, it's free for you, too. So thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday. It's the 13th of June, 2017. It was on this day in 1525 Martin Luther married Katharina von Bora. Scandalous at the time, he was a former monk, she was a former nun. It turned out to be a happy marriage. They had six children. Katharina ran the household. Luther taught and wrote. She had control of family finances, grew the food, brewed her own beer, and she was an excellent cook. It's the birthday of The poet William Butler Yeats, born in Ireland 1865, Irish nationalist, served 6 years in the Irish Senate. He went to art school, tried to follow in the footsteps of his father, who was a famous portrait painter, but he dropped out and devoted himself to poetry. And he tried to dress like a poet. Living in London, somebody wrote about him, Yeats was striding to and fro, a long black cloak drooping from his shoulders, a soft black sombrero on his head, voluminous black silk tie flowing from his collar, loose black trousers. While he lived in London, he met the great unrequited love of his life, Maud Gonne, who was tall and beautiful, also a nationalist, but she was not in love with him, though he did write plays for her to star in. He proposed to her 3 times, and each time she refused. So, in the end, at 52, Yeats married Georgie Hyde Lees and had 2 children with her. It's the birthday of the author Mary Anton, born in Russia, 1881. Left Russia with her family, went to live in Boston, best known for her autobiography, The Promised Land, came out in 1912. And it's the birthday of the novelist and diarist Frances Burney, Fanny Burney, born 1752 in Norfolk, England. She kept a diary for more than 70 years. Her father was a friend of Dr. Samuel Johnson and James Boswell and Sir Joshua Reynolds, so she wrote about them. She married a French expatriate and went to live in France, and there she was able to give a first-hand account of the Battle of Waterloo. And she wrote a couple of novels in the 1770s. Evelina was the first one, and Cecilia, which would inspire Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice. In her diary, she also described the madness of King George III and her own mastectomy performed without any anesthesia except a glass of wine. Here's a poem for today, some lines from The Merchant of Venice by William Shakespeare. The quality of mercy is not strained, it droppeth as the gentle rain from heaven upon the place beneath. It is twice blessed, it blesseth him that gives and him that takes. 'Tis mightiest in the mightiest, it becomes the throned monarch, better than his crown. His scepter shows the force of temporal power, the attribute to awe and majesty wherein doth sit the dread and fear of kings. But mercy is above this sceptered sway. It is enthroned in the hearts of kings. It is an attribute to God himself, and earthly power doth then show likest gods when mercy seasons justice. From Shakespeare's The Merchant of Venice. That's the Writer's Almanac, supported by Staples. Staples offers copy and print solutions for businesses, from color copies to presentations to promotional products. More at Staples stores or staples.com. Staples, it's pro time. And by Progressive Insurance, offering Snapshot, a device that adjusts insurance rates based on safe driving habits. Now that's Progressive. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
And welcome back to Juno Afternoon. Glad to have you with us. I'm Lori Scandling, today's volunteer host. My next guest is Tristan Knutson-Lombardo. He is the Assistant Director of SAIL, and we're going to talk about what SAIL does as well as a new effort that SAIL is pursuing as well. Welcome to the program, Tristan. Glad to have you here.
Thanks,
you've
Lori.
Been with SAIL for 8 years. Talk about, first of all, what does SAIL stand for? It is an acronym. And what is its mission?
Of course, yeah. SAIL stands for Southeast Alaska Independent Living. And we are Southeast Alaska's Aging and Disability Resource Center. So we serve all of Southeast Alaska, Yakutat, down to Metlakatla, everywhere in between. We have four main offices, one here in Juneau, and then Ketchikan, Sitka, and Haines as well. And SAIL, we provide really a wide range of services and supports for seniors as well as people with disabilities. And it looks a little different for each person that comes through our door. A lot of people know SAIL through our recreation program, the ORCA program. They see us up at the mountain in the wintertime doing ski and snowboard lessons, or they might see us out biking and kayaking with folks in the summer. And really the goal, the mission of that program is to get people of all ages, any ability, out of the house, outside, recreating in a really healthy and inclusive way in the community. So a lot of people know SAIL through that lens, but we do a lot of other things as well. We have a loan closet of assistive technology and durable medical equipment. So if you need to borrow a walker, or maybe you want to try out a hearing device or a magnifier, you can loan it through SAIL. We have a taxi voucher program, so it's a subsidy that kind of subsidizes folks' existing transportation options. So if they need to get to the grocery store or take a flight in an odd hour or get to the doctor and the bus or caravan or friends or family can't do that, it's one more option for them, and we help folks with that. We also do home assessments. We call them home maps, home modifications for aging in place. So we go into somebody's home, and if they either their disability has changed, they've recently become disabled, or they're just looking to age in place in the home or the apartment they currently live in, we come in, walk around, do an assessment, both kind of an architectural assessment, but also we talk about existing community services and supports so that person can stay in the home or the community that they want to stay in. One of our our core missions or goals at SAIL is that we want people to be in the least restrictive environment possible in the community of their choice. So that means if they don't want to be in a nursing home, we want to make sure that we can keep them out of that nursing home. Or if they've gone to a nursing home but they want to return to the community, we want to make sure we get them back into the community. We do have a small pot of funds that assists with people transitioning from a nursing home or an institution-like setting back into the community. So, and we also connect people with long-term services and support. So if you have a developmental disability or know someone who does, or if you have a disability of some other type where you know you're going to need in-home care and support, we're kind of the gateway to a lot of those services, as we either kind of screen people for eligibility and also help with that application process to access things like Medicaid waivers and those types of supports. We also are a great place. One of the things I like to share with people is that SAIL, we don't require a diagnosis or a documentation of a disability. We just need someone to say, this is who I am, this is my life story, and these are the goals I have for independence and safety and dignity in my life, and I just need some help achieving those goals. And so sometimes we're the place that can kind of address those one-on-one, but if we're not, we're a great place to start because we know who in the community can, and we can help connect you and your family with the appropriate resources. And we're also really creative thinkers. So if there's not an existing resource, we really pride ourselves on being collaborators and creative and trying to address those problems or those issues in your life.
It's a broad mission.
It is very broad.
And it sounds like SAIL reaches out to support perhaps some of the most vulnerable in our population, or those who have the least resources to understand the complexities of a change in their life or a challenge in their life as well.
Absolutely.
Are those services provided on a sliding scale basis, or how is the delivery of those services and the associated costs figured out?
That's a really great question, and it's becoming ever more pertinent in our fiscal climate in our state. Many of the services we provide, there is not a fee associated with them. And the ones that do have a fee, we, if somebody can't afford that fee, we actively work to find other funding components to help pay for that. So, for example, when we come and do the home map or the home assessment, there is a sliding fee scale with that. But we really want to make sure that cost is not a barrier for somebody that needs that service. So we do work with other agencies, other funders, to make sure that that cost is covered so that we can make sure the appropriate service gets delivered to the right person.
I know that one of the most recent initiatives that SAIL has signed on to is suicide prevention mm-hmm. efforts, and our community is fortunate in that there has been a coalition for the prevention of suicide that has gathered for the last probably 6 or 7 years. Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about that coalition and why SAIL is a partner now in that suicide prevention effort.
That's a great question, and I know a lot of people, they hear SAIL and our mission, and then they hear suicide and suicide prevention, and they go, well, what's the link? We were approached by the Suicide Prevention Coalition early this year in the winter to help with their outreach efforts. For a lot of people in our state know, but many don't, that Alaska has incredibly high rates of suicide, really the highest in the nation. And Juneau is not alone, or is not an exception to that. We still fall under that same category. And so they're really working right now with existing service providers and agencies in the community to double down on their outreach efforts and really make sure that they're hitting some key populations, some high-risk populations in the state. And some of those high-risk populations are seniors. They are at a much higher risk for suicide, as well as people with disabilities. You know, a disability can be, for a lot of people, it can be a life-changing event. It can also be the barriers that we place in front of people with disabilities, whether it's architectural, social, cultural, they can really be difficult barriers to overcome. And when you feel like you're trying, you're bumping up against walls, you're trying everything you got, and the world just isn't either helping you out or respecting you, then that's when we start to see thoughts of suicide start to creep in. And we want to make sure that we are responsive to that, and not just responsive, but actually can intervene beforehand to make sure that people are living healthy, respectful lives. So the Suicide Prevention Coalition reached out to SAIL and said, can you help us with these outreach efforts? So we're in the midst of just trying to reach some of those key demographic groups and getting the word out about suicide, how to recognize signs and symptoms, and the resources available in the community, so that if you yourself or someone you know, you're worried that they are considering suicide, how to intervene and who to go to for help.
What would you say are the signs and symptoms of suicide? I was reflecting with you a little bit earlier that I know a couple of people who have taken their own life, and they were fairly adept at acting in a way that they felt those around them expected in mm-hmm. order to mask a great deal of pain and their hope for more peace through extinguishing themselves, mm-hmm. essentially. So what would we call red flags, and where would we go from there?
Well, the first thing I would say is that suicide is something that cuts across all social strata in our world. No one is exempt from the possibility of suicide, or none of our friends are exempt. We see it happen in all demographics. I will say that, as I mentioned, Alaska has an extremely high rate of suicide and suicide attempts. We're the highest in the nation. We're more than twice the national average. I will also share that in Alaska, 4 out of every 5 suicide deaths are men, and Alaska Native men, depending on the year that you look at, are 4 to 6 times more likely to commit suicide than the national average. And those are just a few of the key kind of stats. Veterans, an extremely high rate among veterans. And so we know that this is a prevalent issue in our state, across our country, and certainly within different groups. One of the things that we hand out when we do this outreach is the Juneau Suicide Prevention Coalition has a really great business card that they hand out. And on the front, it lists some resources in kind of an order of emergency of who to call. So 911 is the top. If it's an imminent threat to life, you or someone else, 911 is the place to call. They also have a crisis line, the Bartlett Regional Hospital Emergency number to call, and some website addresses for resources. But on the back, there's a mnemonic device to help recognize some of the signs and symptoms. And the device is PATH WARM. And it's a listing of about 11 different signs for someone who may be at risk for suicide. For example, Have they said, have they spoken about wanting to commit suicide? Has that come up before, that they've said life isn't worth living, or I've just considered ending my life, or they've said explicitly how they would do it? That's a clear sign or a symptom or a red flag. Behavior that is not normal for that person. So are they abusing alcohol or drugs? Are they engaging in reckless behavior that they were not usually engaging in before? Do you see a dramatic increase in that? In their mood, do you see changes in their mood, greater swings in their mood? Do they seem overall just depressed? Do they seem hopeless? And certainly there are people in our lives that might exhibit one or two of these signs or these symptoms, depending on what's going on in their life. And sometimes that's normal, and we do want to be aware and cautious of that and cognizant of it. But I think, or where we know where it gets dangerous and the risk really starts to increase, is when we see three or four or five of these start to pile up one on top of the other. And the thing that's really important for us to all know is that mentioning to someone, asking someone, talking about suicide is the only way to really intervene and find out, is this person at risk and do we need to find help for this person? A lot of us, myself including for a long time, was worried that if I, to a friend or family member that was at risk of suicide, if I brought it up, that that was going to actually initiate or cause
encourage
them to encourage
that.
It.
Sure.
But what we know is that if somebody's already considering suicide, they've thought about it, they probably thought about how it would happen or how they would do it, and they probably, or there's a good chance they've brought it up before. So you bringing it up is not going to spawn that idea or that thought. They've already been thinking it through their head, and really they're looking for somebody to talk to, an outlet for that to go to. And you might be the start of that conversation. You don't have to do it all. You know, we're not all professional therapists or counselors, and there are those resources out there. But if we don't start to engage in those conversations, then we don't know you know, who those people are in our lives and really how to best connect them to those resources.
If you're just joining me, we are talking with Tristan Knutson-Lombardo. He is the Assistant Director of SAIL, Southeast Alaska Independent Living, which is partnering with the Coalition for Suicide Prevention to do some education and outreach on this topic. Tristan, you mentioned that the reason SAIL is partnering with the Coalition is that you already serve some populations that may be at greater risk for suicide.
Yes.
Tell me a little bit about your outreach efforts to those populations and what they look like.
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. Tonight I'm heading down to the American Legion post-meeting down in Ock Bay to talk to some of the members there, and then I'm going to follow up tomorrow night, Wednesday night, I'm going to head down to the VFW meeting, and there's a lot of crossover membership, but to talk directly to veterans there, because if they themselves are not feeling like they're at high risk, you know, one of the preventative measures we talk about in trying to prevent suicide is that people are connected. They have a community, a group of people that they can rely on, family, friends, and so people that are attending these meetings maybe already have that support network, but they might know other veterans that don't have that support network. And we know that there's a high rate of disability, both physical and mental, among veterans. So it's an important group to reach out to. So I'll go down there and talk to veterans, and you know, people can ask questions and hand out resources. We've also been going to some of the senior centers and dropping off materials at lunch where seniors gather to have meals and get food. So we are trying to reach those populations directly. We're also trying to work and talk to existing service providers. I've spoken to a couple of the Rotary groups, and I have one more to do. And, you know, Rotary, Rotarians are incredibly engaged members in our community, and they both through Rotary but also through their own personal acts do a lot of service in our community. They might be delivering Meals on Wheels, participating in other events where they're working with the public, and it's really important that we're all aware of the signs and symptoms of suicide and what to do if we are recognizing those signs and symptoms.
If we recognize a symptom or we're worried, give me an opening sentence to say to either my elderly relative or a young teen I'm worried about, or a veteran who seems despondent? What's an opening sentence I can use?
That's a great question. There's a brochure that we have, and you can get on the Suicide Prevention website as well, and it's titled Suicide Prevention for Our Seniors, but really I think it's applicable to a much larger population. And the reason I like it is it actually has some of that verbiage in here, and I always look back to it because that's the number one thing that people have a hard time with is, well, what do I say? Somebody just outright says, I feel like I want to end my life. Then what's my response? And that's the hardest thing to kind of take that next step and that plunge into that conversation. So a couple of ideas that I'll throw out there. But if you're concerned that somebody is thinking about taking their life, you can simply ask them, have you been thinking about harming yourself? You can say, to my friend so-and-so, I've been noticing a change in your behavior. I'm concerned about you, and I'm wondering, are you thinking about committing suicide? Just starting that conversation, letting them know that you're there for them, that you have a concern, that you've noticed a change or you've noticed something that's alarming, and then asking the question and just saying, is this something that you're considering? And they may, every conversation is different, and somebody might decide to offer up the information right then. Some people might not want to offer up the information right then. And it is a little bit of a balancing act, trying to not be, overburdening them with too many questions but really just letting them know that you are there, you're concerned, and you want to know if this is a real possibility.
You're noticing.
Mm-hmm. The other great thing to do is that the Alaska Caroline Crisis Intervention Line, and this is on that Juno Suicide Prevention Coalition card. Again, all of this information is on the Juno Suicide Prevention Coalition website, which is junosuicideprevention.org. There is a crisis intervention line. It's staffed 24 hours a day, and you can call. It can be for certainly somebody that is immediately that wants counseling themselves, but also you can call and say, I have this person in my life that I'm concerned about. Give them the lay of the land and say, I don't know where to start. Can you help me with how to start through this conversation? And they are trained professionals, and they can help guide you because each one of these conversations is going to be different. The circumstances are different. The personalities are different. Your
sure.
relationship is different. That's a great resource to
utilize.
What's that
number?
The number is 1-877-266-4357. And those last four numbers spell HELP.
4357 HELP. Mm-hmm. Tristan, thank you so much for your time. We've been talking with Tristan Knutson-Lombardo with SAIL, and they are taking on some suicide prevention outreach effort in collaboration with the Juno Suicide Prevention Coalition. You can find information at junosuicideprevention.org, and the Alaska Statewide Crisis Line, which is 24/7, is available always at 877-266-HELP. Tristan, thanks for your time and your work.
Thanks, Lori.
This is Bird Note. Cities may have been created by humans for humans, but nature persists. Next time you're in the city, look up. When the pigeon flocks flash and flare, wheeling with a new urgency, you might just see a different bird, long-tailed and stiff-winged, in pursuit. Historically persecuted as chicken hawks, for many years, Cooper's hawks were in steep decline due to hunting and the effects of DDT on breeding. Today, populations have rebounded to the point that it's now our most abundant bird-eating raptor. Male Cooper's hawks are significantly smaller than the females, and they tend to prey on mourning doves, grackles, and other easy pickings at suburban bird feeders or in city parks and wooded residential areas. Their big, bulky mates can easily hunt and kill pigeons, and it's usually female Cooper's hawks that are seen flapping stiffly through the skies above the concrete jungle. These hawks add a dash of wildness and drama to the modern cityscape. Look up, and you'll see evidence of nature's persistence in the form of pigeon feathers falling silently from the sky. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
Travel to Sitka this June and join us for the 46th annual Sitka Summer Music Festival. Grammy Award-winning cellist Zool Bailey, the Ataka Quartet, soprano Kate Bass, pianist Natasha Peremski and Nava Perlman, and many other talented musicians will delight your senses with 24 concerts and community events. Tickets and full program details are available at sitkamusicfestival.org. Come to Sitka and experience Alaska's premier chamber music festival.
Are you one of the 120,000 Alaskans with some college but no degree? Finnish College Alaska Initiative from University of Alaska Southeast can help you complete your degree with flexible online learning options, a personalized degree plan, and support on how to fit college into your life. UAS is now offering a 3-credit tuition waiver to eligible applicants. You already work hard. Get rewarded for it. Let's finish that degree together. Call 888-550-6177 or visit finnishcollege.alaska.edu to learn more.
And thanks for staying with us on a Juno afternoon. We're now going to listen to KTOO's Trip Krause, who talked with Rear Admiral Mike McAllister today in our studio ahead of the commissioning of a new Coast Guard cutter, the Bailey Barco. McAllister is the commander of the 17th Coast Guard District, which covers Alaska.
Commission the new fast response cutter, the Bailey Barco. Can you talk a little bit about the that cutter and kind of what it means for Southeast?
Sure. We're particularly excited. Tomorrow we get to commission one of our newest Coast Guard cutters. It's part of a class we call the Fast Response Cutter, and that'll be the Coast Guard cutter Bailey Barco, and we'll be commissioning it right here in Juneau, Alaska. One of the reasons why we're excited about this is because the Fast Response Cutters bring increased capability to Southeast Alaska. And it's capability that we'll be putting to good use in many of our mission areas, including search and rescue, protecting fisheries, ensuring a fast response to any spills of oil or other environmental issues. And so we're excited to have this this new cutter in our fleet.
And the Bailey Barco is going to be homeported in Ketchikan. Like, what is the benefit of having two fast response cutters?
Yeah, the Bailey Barco is actually the second fast response cutter that will be homeported in Southeast Alaska. The first one, the John McCormick, is already in service. Both of those cutters will be homeported in Ketchikan. We do expect to receive at least four more fast response cutters over the next few years. So we'll have fast response cutters throughout Alaska. These cutters bring a number of new capabilities with them, things like being able to be deployed for longer periods of time. The new cutters can go out for 5 or 6 days. They bring increased seakeeping capability, and by that we mean the ability to go out in heavy seas and be able to launch small boats, which are important if you're doing a search and rescue mission or if you're launching a boarding team to do an inspection of a commercial fishing vessel for both safety and compliance with our fishing regulations. And it brings an increase in command and control capabilities, the ability to coordinate activities across not only Coast Guard units, but units from the Department of Defense and other organizations as well. And so these are much greater capabilities than the Island-class patrol boats that they'll be replacing. This is a longer vessel, more capable vessel, and we'll be able to push the vessel further offshore to conduct our many Coast Guard missions as a result of that new capability.
Can you talk a little bit about the Coast Guard presence in Alaska? Because it goes way back when you start looking into the history of it.
Yeah, we're particularly pleased because this year we're celebrating 150 years of Coast Guard service in Alaska. I'm sure most of your listeners know that the U.S. Assumed responsibility from Russia in 1867. It was actually one of our predecessor agencies, the Revenue Cutter Service, that carried the first federal officials into Sitka. And from that patrol, we ended up going throughout Alaska, protecting fur seals and other natural resources. And the Coast Guard has been in Alaska really ever since. We've had cutters in the Bering Sea. We now have cutters every summer in the opening Arctic waters in the Chukchi and Beaufort Seas, as an example. And we're proud of the legacy of 150 years of service.
Alaska has this reputation of being very harsh. Is there, you know, can you talk a little bit about the differences that someone might be encountering when they're serving in the Coast Guard in Alaska versus, say, like Florida or, you know, someplace where it's warmer and a little bit more temperate?
Yeah, I think Coast Guard operations in Alaska, I call them varsity-level operations. Our teams, whether you're talking about our cutter crews, our air crews, even our inspectors that are inspecting commercial vessels, whether it's fishing vessels or cruise ships or any others, have to be at the top of their game here because the impacts of them, of their work, are more significant here in terms of safety and in terms of security than they are elsewhere in the country and around the world. So we take great pride in our work here, and we're always focused on executing all of our missions to the best of our abilities. Now, one of the things that we celebrate here, frankly, is not only the independent spirit of Alaskans, but their willingness to help us carry out our missions. So as an example, when a vessel is in distress, we often find that the communities do whatever they can to help, whether it's launching boats, whether it's fellow commercial fishermen who will respond to a call for help, whether it's we just find that spirit of cooperation here in Alaska.
Going back to the Bailey Barco and here in Juneau, you're getting ready to commission that ship on Wednesday, and then there are public tours on Thursday and Friday. Can you talk a little bit about what people will be able to see and what to expect?
Yeah, we'd love for anybody who's interested to come out and take a tour of the Bailey Barco. It's going to be on Thursday and Friday this week, and the tours will be conducted from 11 o'clock a.m. to 1 p.m. and from 4 to 6 p.m. both days. And you'll see some of the things that I've described in terms of the new capabilities that we have. And I know the crew is proud to show off their vessel. They just recently arrived from Key West, where they were doing sea trials after coming out of the shipyard. And I know they're eager to show off their new vessel, and we'll look forward to seeing as many folks as possible come down and take those tours.
One of the biggest stories that we've had here in the last couple of months in the station is the individual who decided to try to cross the Gatineau on a homemade boat. You know, how often do you kind of see that kind of thing happen where maybe, you know, somebody has this wild idea and then they find themselves in distress?
Well, the case earlier in the week where we assisted a gentleman who was in a homemade boat, make it safely back to the dock, was kind of unusual for us. But as you had mentioned earlier, there is an independent nature to a lot of Alaskans. And, we would just ask that before people set off on new types of adventures in new types of vessels that they contact their local Coast Guard office. And we're happy to work with people before they set out on those voyages to ensure that they're going to be able to make that voyage safely and that we're not going to have to make a search and rescue case out of that voyage and frankly, prevent people from putting themselves at perhaps greater risk than they might realize.
All right. Well, I want to thank you for coming in and taking some time out. And I understand that you're going to be making the rounds the next couple of days. So, and hopefully we'll see you tomorrow for the close ceremony.
Great. Sounds good.
Thanks.
Thank you so much.
The public tours on the Bailey Barco are available 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. and from 4 to 6 p.m. on Thursday and Friday. The ship will be moored at the customs dock near the tram station in downtown Juneau during those tours, again there from 11 to 1 and 4 to 6 on Thursday and Friday. The Coast Guard asks tour participants to wear closed-toe shoes for safety and to leave any large bags in their cars or other locations because they will not be permitted on board. Thanks to KTOO's Trip Krause for that feature with Rear Admiral Mike McAllister about the blessing and launching of the Bailey Barco that will occur here in Juneau. McAllister is the commander of the 17th Coast Guard District, which covers all of Alaska.
If you don't like going to the dentist, it's probably because it was a bad experience for you as a child. Times have changed. The board-certified pediatric dentist at the New Search Children's Dental Clinic will explain things in a way your child understands and provide fun distractions. Kids will actually want to go to the dentist and want to take care of their teeth throughout their lives. The New Children's Dental Clinic at Search is proud to offer pediatric dental services to all Juneau's kids. To make an appointment for your child, call 789-KIDS. This is Sarah Raster from the Year of Kindness Steering Committee. As part of 17YOK, all sorts of groups are adopting specific weeks during which they do something to help spread kindness. This week's group is the Association for the Education of Young Children. You can sign up for a week by emailing 17YOK@JuneauPolice.com. Together, we can make Juneau a better place to live.
Emotions are powerful things. Sometimes it feels like they just take you over.
But what if that's not the way it works? What if we've been thinking about emotions all wrong?
Sometimes you can let emotions control your behavior.
This week, Invisibilia is looking at a whole new way of thinking about our emotions. That's Invisibilia from NPR.
Thursday night at 7 on KTOO News Juneau.
Well, it's been great to have you with us on Juneau Afternoon. Tomorrow on a Juneau Afternoon, Shelley Delaney will host. Aaron Elmore will be here to highlight Theater in the Rough's new production, Running with Pretty Sharp Things, and we'll get a tango lesson on the air. Gershon Cohen will be here to discuss the upcoming Chilkat Challenge Triathlon. Looking at the weather, numerous rain showers for today and the rest of tonight, but tomorrow looks partly sunny with highs in the mid-50s. And I'll mention just briefly that tomorrow's hike is to Peterson Lake Trail. Meet at the trailhead at 23.3 mile at 9:30. It looks like a great day for that 8-mile round-trip moderate hike. By tomorrow night, scattered rain showers again with lows in the mid-40s and some light southeast winds to 10. Thursday, scattered rain, highs around 60. Thanks for joining us again today, and thanks to my producer, Jeff Brown. For Juneau Afternoon, this is Lori Scandling.